My name's Melissa, and I am an alcoholic. It's really not even a big deal. Believe me, throughout my life, I've been called many things, and Michelle is actually pretty good. My sobriety date is May the 18th of 2004, and my home group is the Winchester Group in Memphis, Tennessee. We meet Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. at Woodland Presbyterian Church, and if you're ever in Memphis, we'd love to see you. Just want to take a moment for administrative stuff. I got to thank the board, because I got to tell you, it's an honor to be standing up here. When I first got sober, several women in my home group actually really regularly attended this conference. And when I got sober, you'll find out I was like making babies pretty quickly. It's just part of my story. And so I always had a reason why I couldn't come, right? The May, it's always the end of school. November's always, you know, family functions. I always got something to do. And so I spent years envious all these people coming up here from Memphis. And I just want you to know that I think it's amazing to be invited. Really grateful to be here. I want to thank everybody who's really participated in making this happen. And I want to thank my husband for making the trip with me. Not that you had a choice, but so if somebody has a bottle of water hanging out somewhere, that would be super great. I failed to bring one for myself. Learning to ask for what I need, right? That's real sober of me. So let me go ahead and tell you, I'm super nervous, okay? And I'm nervous because I have this tremendous character defect that I want to be liked, loved, and respected at all times by all people, right? And it really is it's the way I do business. It's my transaction in life. I want to be liked, loved, and respected at all times by all people. And it is a prevailing theme. So if I tell you that on the front end, maybe my ego can get out of the way and we can do this thing for real. I'm supposed to tell you about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And that's always a funny thing for me, because where do you start, Lena? I was born. I was born an alcoholic. I'm going to age myself. I was born in the late 70s in Memphis. I am the only girl of my family. I will tell you, I'm the chosen child. It's very strange to say that. I was the child that was planned for, was wanted, and was cherished. Okay? And while that may not be too big of a deal, it may not sound like a big deal, it really goes into the construction of who I am. I have an older brother, and then, oh, now I've got a lot of water. Yes. You can see my drinking habit in action. Double fisting. So, my home, the house I was raised in, the house I was born in, you know, my father, I'm told, was a practicing alcoholic. This sounds so loud. Thank you. Was a drinker, okay? That's what I remember about my father. By the time I was 2 and a half, my parents split. And so I really have very few memories of my father. I'm told that he was incredibly introverted, shy, and not really warm. And I craved attention. I wanted my father. And so when my parents were splitting up, that was very difficult for me, but pretty quickly my mom had started dating another man who was very warm and friendly and very loving. And so I really took to this, what would become my stepdad, as my father. And in the meantime, when I was about 5, my father died unexpectedly. And that kind of, again, these kind of things go into a lot of my beliefs about myself. I lost my dad really young, but it really, to me, it wasn't a big deal. I just moved on with life because I really didn't have that relationship. But one thing did stand out was that I always had this feeling that I was different. The little girl across the street, she had both of her parents, and I can recall that her home looked so warm and friendly and kind of lit up. You know, they had like ferns hanging on the porch and it was really pretty. And as my memory as a child was that I would turn when I was playing in her yard and look at my house, and my house looked dark and kind of scary. And I can recall feeling like something wasn't right. And I could never put my finger on that. Right? And what happened in my childhood was that we had a lot of chaos. We moved frequently. There was a lot of my mom was a teenage mom, and then she's kind of growing up with us. She goes back to school. My stepdad changed jobs literally every 6 to 12 months. It was maddening. We moved all the time. And I can remember feeling like about the time I could kind of get my feet underneath me, we were going to go somewhere else. And when we had moved from Memphis to New Orleans and New Orleans back to Memphis, and then several houses around town, I'm the kid that got abused in my house for many years. And for many years, I kept that secret. And for me, what becomes pertinent about that is that as a kid, I learned how to live a double life. What you could see from me on the outside was that I wanted to be pleasing. I want to be liked and loved. I want to be the best. I want your attention. Jimmy and I were listening to a speaker on the drive up here, and she said something along the lines of, I want your attention positively or negatively. The worst thing you can do is ignore me. And I thought, that's so true for me. Okay? But so I learned at a young age how to play a role. I learned how to work hard in school and to participate in activities and to show you what I thought you wanted to see so that I could get your love. And that took me through for a long time. And when I was a teenager in middle school, my mom, we had so many crazy things happen. I mean, that guy burned our house down. It was really nuts. But my mom divorced, and about 2 months later, we were living in these apartments, and I can remember feeling so disconnected, so out of touch. I couldn't make friends. I didn't know how to talk to people. I just had a hard time. And I went out to the pool one night, and there was a bunch of teenagers out there, and I'm trying to make friends, and this girl says, hey, come with me, and she hands me a beer. I said, I don't do that. I don't drink. And she goes, no, you need to drink this beer. Okay. So she said, the boys will talk to you if you have a beer. Okay. Right? I want to be liked, loved, and respected, right? So I crack open this beer, and I drink it, and it tastes horrible. I could not believe I put that in my mouth, right? And so I walk around the whole night with a beer in my hand, kind of like I do with my water bottles, right? Walking around all night long, and I made some friends, okay? And the next weekend, I think, well, let's recreate that. I'll go out there again. And now this time, the girl hands me a beer, and she says, now drink it. I said, oh, I drank it last week. She says, no, you didn't. I was like, oh, of course I did. She goes, no, you didn't. And this time you need to drink it. Well, it tasted terrible. So you guys already know, right? I cracked that beer open and I chugged that sucker. And let me tell you, I didn't taste it. And I didn't feel anything too much after that either. And what happened for me, which is really, it talks a lot about this in the book, but I got that sense of ease and comfort immediately. All the chatterbox in my brain went away. The noisemaker, the committee, this constant chatter went away. Okay. And for the next couple of hours, I walked around with another beer in my hand, and I felt okay. As a matter of fact, I felt so okay, I could laugh, and I could tell jokes, and I could talk to everyone there. And I didn't worry about it. And that's all I ever wanted. And alcohol did for me, the very first time I ever drank, everything I had ever wanted. It was the ultimate solution for me. And being 13, okay, it wasn't like I could just continue to drink every time I wanted to, but I certainly created, or I would say sought after, as many opportunities to drink as I could all the way through middle school. And what that looked like for me was that other activities became unimportant, right? The subsequent 2 years, I drank as often as I could, as much as I could. And if you asked me to go do something that didn't include alcohol, I wasn't interested, okay? But what I did do was I maintained a double life. I went to school every day. I made grades. I played on the basketball team. I got a job early, mainly because I needed to fund my alcohol use, right? And I tried to put on the picture that I'm a good kid, and all the way on the back, I'm cunning, I'm manipulating, I'm cheating, I'm stealing, I'm sneaking out my bedroom window at night so that I can go drink. And by the end of my freshman year of high school, I was in rehab. I'd like to tell you it was my last rehab, but it was not my last rehab. It was my first rehab, and I spent 2 years in rehab thinking my drug dealer boyfriend was going to bust me up out of that place, okay? But he didn't come. And they had sent me to rehab in Mississippi. I didn't even know where I was, you know. So about 2 weeks into it, I thought, maybe I should take this thing kind of seriously. Maybe. It's possible that if I continued to drink and do these things that I'm doing, that I could have a problem. Okay? So maybe I'll start listening. And about that time, I earned the pass to go to AA meetings. So the little lady would get me in the van. I was the only teenager that got to go to AA. And they drove me to Into Action and the Action Club. And those of you from Memphis should know these places. And you walk in and there'd be these clouds of cigarette smoke and all these people sitting around like this. And I thought I was in heaven, right? Because first of all, they're cheating, they're giving me cigarettes in the bathroom. Right. But everybody was welcoming. Alcoholics Anonymous was really a great place for me as a teenager, to be frank. I got a lot of attention, right? And so what happened for me was in my first treatment, the best thing that I could take away from it is I could be a potential alcoholic, right? If I keep doing this, I could turn out like you. So I go to AA, I get a sponsor, I've got a home group, darn it, I became the treasurer, right? And I say, I went to AA regularly for 6 years. I worked the steps to the best of my ability, right? I sponsored people, I went to treatment centers, I did everything that I was taught to do, right? And I can remember I was getting ready to leave for college. Now I want to keep, let me tell you guys, my high school career was spent in Alcoholics Anonymous, living out in the country. We had moved out of Memphis and we were living in a small town. And I had this bitter sense of I never fit in. So the way that I tried to fit in with the kids I went to school with was I played bartender to the teenagers. Because I'm going to be honest with you, I never cared about drinking. For me, it was just that easy. Okay? And what I took away from experiences like that was, alcohol's not a problem for me, so I don't really have to do all this stuff, right? I've already done it once. Why go back and look at that book again? It's not an issue. So when I got ready to leave for college, I had an old timer look at me and essentially tell me that my whiny little self needed to be careful because I might end up drinking in college. And I said, I'll show you. Right? So I go to college and I joined a sorority and I'm going to have the perfect college experience. And as a matter of fact, I would go to frat parties. I was the only kid they allowed to dance on the stage because I was the only sober one in the party, right? The band's never worried. But what happened for me was I started getting a lot more ego. See, look at me. Look at what I can do. I don't have to be diligent. I don't even have to really take care of my sobriety. And things would pop up and I'd get really upset. But I'd just go to a meeting and I'd complain and y'all make it okay for me, right? And I moved to other countries. I lived in England and I moved to Mexico. And I went to meetings and I was fine, right? So at around 6 years sober, when the committee started getting really loud in my head, I had no defense. I would try to push it away, I would push it away, and I would push it away. And I would try to, I'll just go to more meetings. I'll just go to more meetings, right? I thought the fellowship could keep me sober. And after about 6 months of this committee getting really, really loud in my head, right? I went to Mexico to school, and the first night I was there, I went out with all the other students and started slamming tequila. And I had planned it for 4 months before I got there. And I want you to know that the first night that I drank in 1998, I never thought about y'all one time. My disease had grown. It had progressed. You know, our book talks about having this progressive illness, that even when we don't drink, it continues to get worse. My first night in Mexico proved that to me. It was as if I had never stopped drinking. And what I might have thought was a potential alcoholic proved very quickly to be an alcoholic. Let me tell you a couple other things, too. I didn't learn much about God growing up. Okay. I got talked to and talked at about God. Among the many moves that we made, we traveled to different churches and different denominations. I mean, we might get the Pentecostals and the snake handlers, and then we'd be in the Catholic Church, you know, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, right? And then my mom would say, well, let's go over here to see this Baptist minister. And I was about as confused as confused could be about God. Okay? And part of my abuse was I was abused religiously. I was told a lot of things that God wanted for me that were not correct in my belief. And by the time I got sober in 92, people started talking to me about God, and I didn't want to hear a word about it. Okay? In my estimation, my grandmother had this little statuette on her shelf when I was little, and it said, it was like a little man, and he was kind of like this, and he was real cute, and he said, I know I'm somebody, because God don't make no junk. And I can remember being a kid and thinking, I so hope that's true. I wanted that to be true. But what happened in my life was that I felt like junk. Okay? And so for me, I had this profound confusion about who is God and what does God have to do with me. And my solution to that was to intellectualize God and to keep God out. So if there is a God, I don't really want to have a relationship with that God, because either that God doesn't have any power or that God doesn't care about me. So by the time I got to college, 3 years sober, I had actually sat in Alcoholics Anonymous, never looking at that resentment, not even calling it a resentment, because I really just didn't even know what it was. But like a lot of us, maybe not all of us, I was a seeker. And I would take classes, and I would try to learn about God, and I would talk to people about God. But I don't really believe in God, but maybe we could learn about God. And where does God fit? So when I started to drink again, what happened for me was all that confusion also went away, because it became a moot point. Because when I'm drinking, I don't need God. I have everything I need when I have alcohol, or so I thought. So in 98, I'm in El Zocalo in Puebla, Mexico. I'm slamming tequila. It is a good time. I'm making friends, right? I was there for about maybe 8 weeks. And in that 8 weeks, if I wasn't drinking, I wasn't speaking Spanish, because I was really anxious about my Spanish. And in that 8 weeks, I almost failed my classes. I put myself into some seriously scary, risky situations. And I was very resentful at my teacher, because she scheduled our classes for 8 a.m. And how dare she do that? I mean, doesn't she know? It is summertime, right? Right off the bat, that ego and that self-centeredness was huge, right? It was everybody else's fault but mine. If you had had the life that I lived, if these people had done the things to you that they had done to me, you would do this too. I deserve to have some time. These are the things that I told myself when I drank. Okay? And when something really painful or difficult would happen, I would have this moment of, what is wrong with me? Why do I keep doing this? And I would quickly put that out of my head and find someone to blame. And what happened for me was I came back to Memphis and my drinking launched. I got a job in a bar. I was supposed to be saving money to move to Argentina. I'm really all about the ego, right? Look at what I can do. And so I'm working in this bar and I've got another job and I'm going to school, but I'm drinking and I'm really liking drinking and I'm flunking out of my classes. And then they tell me I'm not eligible to go to Argentina because my grades really aren't good enough. I don't want to hear that. You know what? I don't care. I didn't want to go anyway. Right? So what do? I get another job in a second bar, because working in bars seems fun, right? Within about 18 months of drinking, I can't go to a full day of classes without stopping at the bar around the corner and getting a to-go drink. Okay? Which, if you're from Memphis, I mean, you got to know where to get the to-go drinks, right? So, I took this class. It was like U.S. history, Civil War to current day or something. And it was my 7 p.m. Tuesday, Thursday class. And I would go to RP Tracks, and I'd eat from 4 to 5:30. And I'd have a couple of drinks. And I'd always say, I'm going to have one, maybe two, right? It's a long day. And then I'd get ready to go, because when I put alcohol in my body, what happens for me is like a fever comes along. When I put alcohol in my body, it hits my stomach and I can feel it. And before the first one really settles in, I've already ordered the second one, right? And then these people need to bring me the third one in the to-go cup. So I go walking, half tipsy across campus to go to my U.S. history class. And we have a break and we're out there and I'm having a cigarette. And the teacher comes out and he starts kind of talking to me and kind of almost hitting on me, right? And I'm about half lit. And I said, you need to back off. And he said, oh, okay. And later we start talking and he's in AA. And I go, I don't do that anymore, right? I saw him this morning, by the way. He's still sober. And we laugh. He goes, were you really drunk that whole semester in my class? I was hammered. Hammered. He goes, you really wrote one of the best papers I ever graded. Right? Who knows what I said? I mean, you know. But, you know, alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. I started drinking, and I had that bitter sense, and Jimmy could tell you, I still have this to this day. I always think there's something more, right? There's always something else. There's something better around the corner. I always feel like I'm missing out on something, right? So, you know, I'd be dating somebody. It just seems like somebody else could be better, right? So I'm dating somebody. I got one over here waiting in the wings, right? And, you know, I work this job, but that job could be better. So I'm always plotting and planning and conniving, right? And really what it is I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't even know how to talk about it. Just never okay. About the moment I'd sit down to do anything, I'd get this feeling, this angst. I couldn't move on. I just always thought something out there was going to make it better. First year I was drinking, I dumped my boyfriend. God love him. And I started dating this fella from Memphis who was living in New York City. Now that, my friends, is something better, right? So I'd fly up to New York about every 4 to 6 weeks and stay for a 4-day weekend. And I thought I was like on top of the world, okay? The first time I go up there, I go to meet him. We're gonna go for drinks before dinner. This is very, very swanky for a girl who's come from nothing. And I got my ball gown on and we go to Windows on the World, which was a bar at the top of the World Trade Center, you know, at sunset. It's very magical, okay? And I can remember standing there with my overpriced martini and just thinking, just like Bill Wilson said, this is it. This is what I've always wanted. And at the end of that night, I fell off the curb coming out of the Venus Room, slamming whiskey, and my ball gown was lost in sludge on Park Avenue, you know, and I carried myself back to the hotel room puking, thinking, why did I do this to myself? And the next day, saying, let's go do it again. That's my alcoholism. I could tell you a million stories, but they're all exactly the same. That's how I drank every single time. Once I put alcohol in my body, I cannot control the amount that I drink. Okay? I'd like to tell you it could be 2 or 22, but it's never 2, ever. I cannot drink 2. I don't know when I'm going to drink, how much I'm going to drink. I don't know when I'm going to stop. Something has to stop me. The bar has to close, and there has to be no other place to go. I started learning the tricks for that. When I started drinking, I drank with people who went home. What is wrong with them, right? They are lousy drinkers, and they're terrible friends. They really shouldn't let me stay out like this. And what happens? I move on to the late night bar. So I got a whole new group of people, and then those people go home. What is wrong with them? Okay? They are not taking this seriously. So then I got to go to the 24-hour bar. And in the 24-hour bar, you know, I got to have pick-me-ups to keep me going. So my alcoholism in about 6 years turned really ugly, really fast. And what happened for me was I drank myself out of several jobs. I drank myself out of every relationship that I had. Boyfriends, friendships. My family was destroyed by my drinking. My mother, I used to drive by my mother's office. My mom was an administrator for a home healthcare agency, and so she worked a lot. And I would drive by her office knowing like when the staff would be gone, and I would hit her up for some money. And I would give her the story, right? I'm out of gas, I can't do this. And my mom would know that that was not true. And she would say no to me. And I would do what I had always done. I would push, 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 and pressure. And I would use my guilt tactics and my manipulation. And she would give me money that she did not want to give me. And then I would go and do what I did every time. So my mom initiated an intervention on me in 2003-ish. It's a little hazy because I'm a little hazy in that period. I was drinking a lot, and I was being boosted up in order to continue drinking a lot, and that was really requiring a lot of time and money on my part. And my mom initiated this intervention. Of course, she didn't tell me. I think she started watching that TV show, right? So I show up at my brother's house. I am under the influence of chemicals, a lot of them. And I go in, and my mom, I walk in, it's just like the show, right? I walk in, and I'm like, what's happening? I know what's happening. I know what's happening. And expletive, expletive, expletive later, how dare you do this to me? How dare you? If you would just leave me alone. It's our song. If you just leave me alone and let me do what I'm doing, I wouldn't hurt. The only reason you're hurt is because you're trying to interfere. And I take off, you know, indignant and ashamed, totally ashamed. So what happens is that I start going to jail, okay? It's no shocker. I'm a terrible criminal. That should be on the record. I'm a terrible criminal. I never set out to commit crime. I'm really a terrible liar, too. I'm just not good at these things. I really just want to change the way that I feel and get ease and comfort. And in order to do those things, I started committing crimes. And I just started getting caught because I'm not very good at it. Okay. So I start going to jail, and what starts to happen is my family is, I would go on these escapades and I would disappear for weeks. Okay. I would take off and I would not come home, and people would be looking for me, and nobody would know where I was, and then I would surface in jail. And so the first time that happened, no one would come pick me up, or no one would bail me out, let me say. And when I got out, after my time served, my older brother came to the jail to pick me up, which was petrifying to me. I want to tell you that my older brother's like Mensa smart. He's like the straight-A student guy. I'm not telling you that he's like super-duper nice or, you know, well put together, but he's super smart, and I've always put him on a pedestal. Like, he's the guy I'm always in the shadow of, and so he's the one that drives up to the jail to get me. Hang my head. And he basically says, what you hanging your head about? You did it. That's true. And, you know, we have some discussion about what had happened. And that's really about it. He drops me off. He just didn't really have a whole lot to say. I spent the next 2 months trying to not drink or do other things on my own. I thought my willpower would get me through that. If I could just say that I wasn't going to do it, see this thing, this trip to jail, it was really bad. I probably shouldn't do that anymore. So my parents let me move back to their house out in the country. They have no neighbors. Okay. They just got their first liquor store about 5 years ago, and I've been sober 15, so there was no liquor store, you know. And my parents don't drink. So I'm out in the country on a farm with no alcohol. And my mom says, you know, Melissa, maybe you should go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Things seem to be better then. And I said, I don't have a problem with alcohol, I have a problem with drugs. It's the drugs. If I just stop doing the drugs, then I'll be okay. I don't want you to take away my alcohol. And I stay out there for 6 weeks. Now let me tell you about an alcoholic who doesn't have any booze. My mother's house became spotless. I'm in there cleaning the wallpaper in the kitchen, and I'm losing my mind because I've got all this, you know, angsty energy, and I can't get still. And I'm grumpy, and I'm miserable to be around, right? I'm flying off the handle. My mom says, maybe you should go to church. I said, that's a good idea. As a matter of fact, I got a job at the church. I figured if I worked for Jesus, if I work, right, I'll go work. So I clean the church. It's not good. Not good for me. So what happened is, on March 11th of 2004, my parents took me to a Mexican restaurant for my birthday. Okay, I was 26. When they were not looking, I ordered a margarita. It came in a goblet. It was huge. It was like a fishbowl. Okay, and I sucked that thing down like the end of time was coming. And my parents came around the corner about the time I was finishing it, and they're both of their eyes, they look like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And I'll have another. Yeah. And my mom said, do you think you should do that? In my head, no, I don't think I should do that. But yes, I will do that. And so I drink another one, we had birthday dinner, we drive back to the country, and I'm in the back of my dad's truck, right? And I'm holding on to the seat, my parents did not know this, and I'm thinking to myself, when you have to jump out of a vehicle, is it a stop, drop, and roll? Like, I don't know how to do this, but I gotta get out of this car. Because see, the phenomena of craving for me kicked in. I had been 6-7 weeks without anything in my system, and now I've put alcohol in my body. So now I've gone from total obsession, 24 hours a day, to complete craving. And I am willing to jump out of a moving vehicle. And I get home, there's no booze. I promise you, I drank everything in their cooking cabinet. I've gone through and tried to find stuff in my bags that I had packed. I'm looking, there's nothing. I'm starting to lose my mind. I'm starting to become almost crazy psychotic. And my mother's like, what is going on with you? I don't know. A couple of days later, it dies down. St. Patrick's Day comes. My mother says, you know, you've been doing a really good job. Here's $20 in the car keys. Be home at midnight. So, I told y'all that I'd take off, right? When I was three, I just want you to know, when I was three, I really wanted some candy from the Rexall at the end of the street, and I got on my big wheel, and I went to Rexall. And I didn't come home for 4 hours. Three. I've been doing this a long time. She gave me the keys, and I was gone. And I went to RP Tracks, where my brother worked, and I ordered a drink, and they poured me a drink because they know me, and that's how they do. And before I can get the first one down, because I want you to know that as soon as I knew that I was going to drink, I felt better. Okay? And then I got there, and I felt relieved. And before I could finish the first one, the guy had the second one up, and my $20 was gone because I got a tip, right? And I'm on the phone, and I'm making calls, and I'm cutting deals, and I got to keep going. And that went for 8 more weeks. My family didn't know where I was for 8 more weeks. That car was found, totaled 3 days later. Forgot to tell y'all that when I left, my mother said, or my dad, I'm not sure, I just paid that car off and dropped the insurance to liability. Don't mess the car up. The car was totaled 3 days later. I actually drove it into some floodwaters, it was really bad, and swam out of it and left it and just kept going. I knew that if I went home, they were going to ask me to go to treatment. And I want you to know that I could not even fathom a day without alcohol. I did not want to not drink. For me, it was everything. The book talks about how alcohol becomes paramount to all other interests. I cared about nothing. Everybody was an obstacle in my life. That's what I had to do. And so that's what I did. And World Trade Center, sleeping under cars in South Memphis. Okay? That's what happened to me in 6 years. And what also happened is that when I resurfaced in jail, which was also in Mississippi is very special to me. I keep going to Mississippi to get sober, apparently. The last day that I drank, I had not slept in about 10 days, best I could tell. I was not in a safe place, and I was very afraid to go to sleep. And so I continued to drink and to do other things. And on the 10th day, I can recall saying to someone, I feel like the walking dead and something is about to happen. And that something was that I went to jail. And I didn't get out. My family had had missing persons reports out on me. I had declined to speak to my mother on the phone when a police officer had stopped me one day recognizing my face from a report and broke my mother's heart. What I did to my family was to destroy my family. My parents did not sleep for many, many weeks of my use. And of course, I didn't know that because I believed I wasn't hurting anybody. So I went to jail. Apparently I committed a felony. But I didn't know. I didn't know it was a felony. And what had happened was, I woke up about 7 days into this deal, and try to make this part condense. I looked around, and there were about 32 women in this little tiny jail, and not even enough beds for everybody. And what happened in the 4 months that I was there was I observed that every woman that I was in jail with had done exactly what I had done. Every woman I was in jail with was planning on doing it again. And I had this feeling that something, I didn't want that. Something was different. And I couldn't really put my fingers on what that was. And a woman came to the jail bringing a meeting. And she would come about every 3 weeks or so, and she brought a meeting. And the women would go to her meeting so they could get out of the pod, and they would sort of laugh and make fun of her, really. And it frustrated me because I could recognize what she was doing. And so I remember telling the lady, I'm not going to come back to your meeting because it really bothers me the way that people treat you. But if you have a book, I'd like to read it. And she gave me a 12 and 12. I don't know why. I didn't have a big book. And I went back to my cell block, whatever it was, and I read the 12 and 12. And did y'all know that 12 and 12 was around? Because I got sober in 92 the first time, and I'm going to tell you, I did not recognize that book, okay? And I was like, man, they've made some good literature, huh? Some, like, really good stuff. And so I look at the copyright, dummy, you know, it's always been there. The problem is I don't remember it because I didn't relate to it because I wasn't an alcoholic. See, I sat in AA for 6 years, not able to surrender. So really, I never really could relate to the literature because it didn't really apply to me. So what happened for me is I read this 12 and 12, and this whole program starts lighting up for me, right? And I am feeling this thing happen inside of me, and I'm starting to think about things that I haven't thought about, and I'm starting to feel this shift, and I don't have anybody to talk to about it, and I don't know what to do with it. And one day I'm in the shower, and God, this little tiny jail had this like communal shower, right? And you could see it from the door too, it was terrible. And I'm in there having my shower, and I'm praying, I can't do this. And I don't know what to do, God. Show me what to do. And that's the moment of surrender for me. It's the moment that it all changed. The moment that one piece of me opened up just enough that power could enter. That's the moment. And I was overcome. Now, who in the jail is going to explain that to me? I don't even know what's going on. Right? But something's changing. The next week, this girl comes into the jail, and you know she snuck some stuff in, and they're all in the corner, hovered over there, doing what they're doing, and they say, "Hey, Melissa, you want some?" And I said, "You don't have enough for me. If you give me one, I'm going to be climbing that wall, and I'm going to get shot. You don't have enough for me." Who is this person talking? That is not me. Okay. Something is changing. My mother would not bring me any money in jail. She had given me all the money she was going to give me. So she would bring me books. She brought me a book called Bad Girls of the Bible. Tell you about my mama. She gave me this book. I was one of profound confusion. I didn't think God wanted anything to do with me, and at this point I was too dirty and too bad for God. She gave me this book called Bad Girls of the Bible, and it changed. Changed. Suddenly, I became open. Maybe, just maybe, I could be loved. Maybe, just maybe. And step two happened for me. Maybe, just maybe, it can be different. And what happened subsequent to that is that here I am looking at felony prison time in Rankin County Jail, Mississippi, which is not air conditioned, I'm just saying, and it was summer. So that sounds terrible, okay? And I learned from the other convicts that I'm in jail with that Rankin County Jail does not have alcohol and drug treatment. But that's what the option, that's where I'm headed. And it was pretty sure that's where I'm going for this thing that I had done. And I tell my mom in a visit, I said, "Listen, I'm pretty sure I'm going to prison. Like, this is really what's about to happen. And I've just come to a place of acceptance. I did what I did, and this is what it is." And my mother said, "Wait a minute." But she came back the next week and says, "I hired you a lawyer." I said, "You don't have to do that. You've spent enough money." She said, "I hired you a lawyer. He'll be here to see you this week." So this fella comes in to see me, and he's kind of, to be honest with you, he's kind of jerky. And he's like interrogating me and asking me, he's interviewing me to see if he's going to be my lawyer, right? So I'm answering his questions, and he says, "Miss Perry, what do you intend to do if you get out of jail?" And I said, "Well, I have to go to treatment because I cannot live out there without drinking. I no longer know how to live without drinking, and if I don't go get some help, I'm going to walk out of here and drink, and I know that." And he said, "That's the right answer. I'll take your case." And he was 27 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and apparently the only lawyer in that town who was sober. And my mother just happened to walk into his office. You know. For me, that's the first taste of a third step. I didn't even know it was working steps, y'all. That's the first taste. I'm willing to do whatever needs to come. I'm available. I'll show up. And so what happened is I got sent to treatment. I go, and I'm going to be liked, loved, and respected. I'm a number one student in treatment, by the way. And that pisses people off. And so I had no friends in treatment. Nobody wanted to hang out with me. I went to the halfway house. I got a job like I was supposed to, and I did what I was supposed to do. I say that because really I broke a few rules here and there, but I kind of justified that because they were much worse than me. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a sponsor, and I got a sponsor who had something that I wanted to have. I got a sponsor who lived a life that I wanted to live. She smiled every day. She looked happy. She had freedom. She also drove a really nice car. That helped. And she met with me once a week. And what she did for me was that she gave me 2 hours of her week every week at her house, and she read the Alcoholics Anonymous book to me. And she walked me step through step how to do this thing. And she showed me through her demonstration what being a sober woman, what living a sober life looked like. But she, mostly what she did, y'all, was she gave me her time. She took my call every morning. She met with me for 2 hours, and I met her at a meeting every week. She made me welcome, and she made me a part of. Okay. So one night, I called her and said, I can't meet you at the meeting tonight. Gosh, I'm really sorry, I'm running kind of late. So I'm gonna go to this meeting closer to the halfway house so I'm not late, because I know you don't like it when I'm late to AA meetings. And she said, what's his name? There's no he. She said, you are so incapable of differentiating the true from the false that you don't even know that you're lying to me. Yeah, what do you say to that? That's true. Well, his name's Jimmy. I started following Jimmy around. I did. I saw his name on the board at the AA group, and he's a Saturday night speaker, and I was working at this like clothing store, so I had my really good threads on, you know, and I go rolling up to the meeting with my theme music, right, because I'm going to make an impression, right, and then there's nobody outside. Theme music wasted. I walk in, the meeting's like this, and I come in, of course I'm late, I come in, and he's coming to the podium, and I sit down at the only chair, and he is right dead center. I mean, it is great. I've got perfect vantage point, and Jimmy is dynamic, okay? He starts talking, and it's like a light, and my little mothy self wants to fly around him. And he gets to the end of his talk, and he comes walking down the aisle, and I am like fluttering, and I'm swinging my hair, and he walks right up to the girl in front of me. Soul crushing. So I demoralized. I was really angry. And I gave him the cold shoulder when I saw him later that night out. But then Sunday night was candlelight meeting night, and he came in and he touched my arm and he asked me for my book and what's the topic. And I was like, here. And we went out on a date because he told me he broke up with that girl. And we got married 13 weeks later. He tells the rest of the story, but. And I'm going to tell y'all, when he came to pick me up at the Starbucks, I mean, I made sure I had my smart-looking book that I was reading out, and I was like, you know, adjusting, because I got to control perceptions. I work in this transaction of got to be liked, loved, and respected. Okay. And I see, Jimmy and I got married, and we were pregnant. And I was so honored that he married me. I didn't really feel like I was very worthy. I developed feelings of fear. We got married in April, and I prematurely delivered our twins in July. And in August, we buried them both. And I thought my world would end. I was one of profound confusion who had come to have a relationship with God. And then I did what I was supposed to do, and it did not work out the way that I thought it was supposed to work out. And I became very angry. But I went to this home group where everybody was grateful. They're always talking about, aren't you grateful? No, I'm not grateful. And for about 12 years, I would go to my meetings and somebody would say, well, I'm just so grateful. And I'd go, I'm not. What are y'all doing that I'm not doing? Because I ain't feeling it. I'm going to tell you that when our children died, I used to say I didn't think about drinking. I did think about drinking one day. And I thought it would be a terrible dishonor to my children that I had buried them. If I drank, I just thought it would dishonor them somehow. And really what I did was I kept driving people to AA. I just kept signing up to take these women from the treatment center to AA. It was what I could do. It's just what I could do. It's about the only thing I could do for a long time. And it really, I recognize it saved my life. Because absolutely God has worked through you guys every time. But I was angry. And I was resentful. And I was confused. And I felt so not a part of for so long. But I'm belligerent, so I keep going to AA and telling people I'm not grateful. That's what I did. And I do fits and starts. I get really into steps, and I do really well, and then my life gets busy, right? Because Jimmy and I, we got pregnant again, and we had a beautiful, like, almost 10-pound baby. Jeez Louise. Right? And then I went back to school and I got a degree and I got a master's degree. And then Jimmy goes back to school and gets a degree and gets into law school. About the same time we have another baby. Right? And then we're in law school and I'm trying to work and whoa. And about the time he gets out of law school and gets his job, I start a private practice. So now I've got a business to run and he's trying to make partner in the second year because we're crazy people. Sorry. And this is our life. Our life gets really busy, and everything gets put into these children. I have beautiful children, by the way, and they're amazing. I'll show you all pictures, okay? But everything gets really subsumed into, I got to make this family, and I got to have this house, and I got to make this career, and I have to, and you need to like, love, and respect me at all times. I'm doing everything right, and I'm not going to meetings. And about 3 years ago, I drive home from my very lucrative, I have a pretty successful business. We have a great house. We moved out of the starter house. Now we got the bigger house. Damn it, I got the minivan. The kids are in private school. I've checked the boxes. And I drive home from work one night, and I pull over on the side of my cove, my fancy cove, right? Everything I wanted as a child. And I call my sponsor, and I said, I got nothing. I got everything and I got nothing. I got nothing. I feel nothing. I can't even feel grateful. And she said to me, what do you think God wants for you? I said, wants for me? What kind of question is that? And then I heard myself. I said, I don't know. I've only been thinking about what God wants from me. And I'm not doing a very good job at that. What does God want for you, Melissa? God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And I'm not. I'm not. So we talked about what I can do. We talked about how I made my business my God, my marriage my God, my children my God, money my God. I give everything to those. Where's my prayer life? Where's meditation? Where's the self-examination? What am I doing? And I said, I don't have time. She said, you're the only one that's in charge of your schedule. Oh, crap. That's right. I own my own business. I don't even have a secretary. If I did, I'd fire her because I'm really bad at it. What does God want for you? So the last 3 years, you know, and I'm not going to tell y'all that I never went to meetings. I went to meetings. I went just enough so you remember my name. I don't want you to forget me, right? But what happened for me was I had to come back to the basics. And that's difficult when your ego is overgrown. It's like a weedy garden, right? It's like a jungle. I'm out there just chopping it with a damn machete, right? One day at a time. And the truth is, I can't do it. My will is not enough. I've had so many plans and designs, right? The book talks about all these moral convictions. I'm going to be so moral and ethical, and I'm going to do this. And I fail. Why? Because the needed power is not there. There's only one who has the power, and it ain't Melissa. And it never was. But I had to face my resentment too, y'all. I was so resentful at God. He took my children away. And I realized that my life had stopped with the fact that my children died, and I had forgotten to be grateful for the ones that were alive. I did everything outside that I was supposed to do, but the inside, I was frozen. So coming back into recovery is not about going back to meetings for me. It's about trying to come back into the program. So this year was a year of change. You know, I realized that I was holding on to an old sponsor because I want to be liked, loved, and respected. I was staying in a home group that I was not growing in because I want to be liked, loved, and respected. And I had to start making some choices. Where does God want me to be? How do I find that out? I got to start getting still. It's a surrender again. And it's difficult because my ego is so big. It tells me that I know the answers. And I struggle and struggle and struggle. Come back. What does God want for me? This year, as a matter of fact, like 3 weeks ago, I was at my home group's business meeting. And they said, and by the way, I picked up my 15-year medallion. I'm the baby. I joined this home group. I mean, they're like, I don't know what they are. 50 years sober, 30 years sober. I try to surround myself with people who are wise. And they said, we need a GSR. You know why? Because none of them want to do it. They've already done it. And I'm like, oh, I need a GSR. And I'm like, no. Okay. Everything I do is like, there's this struggle. I don't really want to do that, God. Okay. You know? And every time that I have said yes to a request from Alcoholics Anonymous in the last 24 months, I have been so grateful. And God has shown up in my life and in the life of my husband and my children and my business and the people that are in my life. And I'm not going to tell you, you know, I'm a pain to live with, if you want to know the truth. He'll tell you about it another day. I'm not great. Sunday. But the truth is, it's all these growing pains. And the last thing I will say to you is I've spent so much time afraid to tell you the truth. What if you don't like, love, and respect me? What if you find out I'm 15 years sober and I haven't been doing it? Right? What if? What if you don't want me to be a part of the club anymore? Right? And what I found this year is that the only place, the only language of the heart that I know is honesty, willingness, open-mindedness. And that as going through these steps again, that it's all those defects of character that I've discovered in 6 and 7 that have been blocking me from you. You're not jerks and all this. It's the block inside of me. And that all it has taken is the willingness to show up again. But I thought I was supposed to already know and have it together. And every day, you show me that there's grace and just keep coming back. And I'm so grateful to be here with you this weekend. So thank you for the time.